Good morning, guys. All right. Excuse me, I'm a little, got the crud stuff that's going around all over, and so I have to put up with my snorting and sniffing the whole time here. All right, so thanks for coming this morning. I know it's, as the weeks go on, it gets a little harder to get out of bed sometimes, and when it's cold, you just want to kind of stay in there, but thanks for coming, and we'll try to make it helpful for you. So today we're going to talk about thorns and thistles, if I can say it right all morning long, thorns and thistles, and why work is frustrating. So our big three questions that we're covering these whole 6 weeks and kind of beyond are: what's God's original purpose for work? Because when we understand why God created work and what it was for, that helps us echo back to that as we rethink work in this day and age. Secondly, why does work so easily frustrate us? And we're going to camp pretty hard on that today. And then how does the gospel restore God's intended purposes for work? Ultimately, we want to be able to come out of here with a better vision for how our work can be, how God can use us as a worker, and really even what our calling is. And so that's what we're all about these 3 weeks. In the first week, we looked at God as a worker, the idea that God is not just kind of back there starting the motion of the world and then kind of sitting back and watching. He's not just an observer. He's actually a worker. He's a worker from the beginning, and he continues to work now. And because we are image bearers of God, work is a central part of our identity. It's something that we get from him as his creation. And then last week, Mike walked us through really the idea that God created these canvases in the world and provided them with, created the world with raw materials, and then asked man to really develop them, to co-labor with him in essentially painting the canvases with the materials that he had created. And that our chief job as a worker, just as our chief job in life, is to advance his kingdom. As he said, into every nook and cranny of the world. And I love that idea that advancing God's kingdom is not just about big picture things and great initiatives and kind of world-class undertakings, but it's also, and just as much and perhaps even more, about extending God's kingdom into every nook and cranny of our lives and the lives of people around us. So every nook and cranny of people, every nook and cranny of work, every nook and cranny of our family, there's no place that God's kingdom can't or shouldn't extend to, and our job is to co-labor with God in that. And so that, I think that begins to kind of give us a new view of what work can be. But almost immediately, we start bumping up against our own limitations, the limitations of the people around us, the limitations of the systems we're in, and those things are the thorns and thistles. And unless we understand why those things are there and how we begin to deal with them, and really the right way to deal with them, the right way to see them, we're going to keep bumping up against those things in a way that pushes us back rather than becomes a hurdle to get over it at some level. So the quote we looked at from the very beginning was, "All human work is not merely a job but a calling, and our work can be a calling only if it's reimagined as a mission of service to something merely or beyond merely our own interest. Thinking of work mainly as a means of self-fulfillment and self-realization slowly crushes a person and undermines society itself." So that means that even if I completely understand how God made me, how God designed me, and even if I can articulate very clearly what I feel like my calling is in the world in a way that is fulfilling to me as a person, even if I can do that and I feel like I'm sort of firing on all cylinders in exactly the way God made me, if I'm not doing that as a means of a calling for what he wants me to do, if it's all about me, it will, in the end, be unfulfilling to us. So work was always supposed to be about God, and when we make it about us, it becomes a crushing burden. And we make it about us because of sin, and that's what we're going to look at today. So number one on your outline says, is the cartoon the next thing? Okay, sorry. Let's look at a cartoon here first. This is, I think, pretty funny. This is our new employee, Mark. Mark was a Navy SEAL. He fought in 3 separate conflicts. He once fought off 100 insurgents and saved a town. Show Mark how we roll at this company. Okay, today I'll be reformatting my PowerPoint deck because someone said the design is not organic. What does that mean? It doesn't matter. I'll just push some things around and hope the guy who complained doesn't attend the next meeting. How do you survive this place? I don't like to use the word hero. We all work with people like that. That's how work is sometimes. It just feels like we're going through the motions, pushing things around, hoping that whoever complained doesn't show up at the next meeting. Well, number one on your outline talks about this. When Adam and Eve sinned in the garden, every aspect of creation was affected, and work was placed under God's curse so that it no longer fulfills its original purpose. Romans 8, 19 through 22 talks about this, harkens back to this. In verse 20 it says, "For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God." So what this says is that God so ordered the world that as the creation gets put under bondage, there's a natural futility to work so that we would not find it overly fulfilling, okay? So that we would not find our greatest fulfillment, our greatest joy in something other than God. God created or ordered the world under the curse such that work will always be futile to us. So it wasn't just man's heart that was affected by the fall. All of creation was affected by the fall. Man's sin caused death and destruction and decay, and that extends not just to humans, but to everything around us. So that's why we have disease. That's why we have broken human systems that we work in. It's not simply because of sinful man. It's because the whole thing is contaminated and corrupted. Everything that we're a part of is that way. And so even when we sense things are good, even when we taste things that seem to taste good or experience things that seem to taste good, they're really only a minor taste of how God originally intended it and how God can redeem it to be in the future. And it's important to understand this as we experience good things, even in our own work. It's just a taste of what can come when we're in perfect peace with him. My sister is dating a guy who, Walter, who used to be the co-CEO of Whole Foods. And he has all these connections to all these great organic growers of fruit and vegetables and all this kind of stuff. And so he sends us from time to time these really nice packages of fruit. And this is not like Fruit of the Month Club. This is like you would not believe. Like this summer he sent 36 perfect peaches to us. These were organic peaches. They were delivered. I mean, it was like the Hope Diamond had been delivered to us the way it was packaged. And each one was individually wrapped and they were straight off the tree. They were picked ripe. So you kind of had to eat them right away. And by the way, if you eat about 12 peaches in one sitting, it will bother your stomach. I can verify that completely. But it was worth it. But these are those kind of peaches where you have to eat them over the sink because you bite into it and it's just drooling down your face. It's the sweetest thing you've ever had. And when you taste it, you think, oh man, this must be what fruit is like in heaven. This is how a peach was meant to be. Well, my daughter gave me some jelly beans, and these are Bean Boozled jelly beans for Christmas in my stocking. And there's a peach jelly bean in here. And so if you try one of these peach jelly beans, it kind of a little bit tastes like a peach, but it doesn't have the juice, it doesn't have the texture, it doesn't have the sunshine packed right into the fruit like a real peach does. The peach jelly bean is just a mere taste, a smither of what a real peach is like. And by the way, some of the orange ones that look like peach actually taste like barf. Now, I don't know what that's even about, but that's somebody's kind of joke there. And so, but this is how it is for us. We taste something and we think it's the great peach. Oh, this is what heaven's like. But really, we're just tasting the peach jelly bean. Real heaven, real redemption, the real new kingdom is going to be more like how the real peach was. And we just get a taste of it. So we should long for these great experiences that do give us a taste of heaven, but we should always realize that even those are corrupted. They're just not quite all that. We always sense that something's missing because God doesn't want us to be satisfied with a sinful world. He brings about futility so that we will always seek redemption. So God, in his grace, even orders the sin of the world so that it will bring us back to him. Not just because we fail, but because we long for more. Number two says, God's cursing of work does not remove all of work's benefits. So it still meets our physical needs and others, but work also produces thorns and thistles. Thorns and thistles, which symbolize the painful, unintended consequence of work. Here's where this comes from in Genesis 3:17-19. It says, cursed is the ground because of you. This is God talking to Adam and Eve. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain, you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you. And you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. God pronounces curses on Adam and Eve, and because we are all born in Adam in sin, those curses are on you and I. We live in that infected, corrupted lineage and world that they gave us. And the curse is on the ground too, which is where Adam did his work and where we do our work. So there's a connection between our sin and the pain of our work. Now it's important to realize that there's a distinction here about curse. All right, work is not a curse. Work is under a curse. You see the difference? See, because work was given to man before the fall. So work can't be a curse if it was given to man before the fall. God himself is a worker, therefore he can't do something that's unholy. Okay, so work is good. Work was given before the fall, but after the fall, work was placed under a curse. In the same way, by the way, that childbearing was placed under a curse. Nobody would say that childbearing is a curse, at least not in most times, but it's under a curse, therefore there's pain, there's heartache, work is the same way. And so work still provides some tangible blessings for us, but it also brings these unintended, painful consequences, and those are the thorns and thistles. And so the bulk of our morning is going to be looking at several of these things, and then we will contrast those a little bit, look to the future of how some of these things can be redeemed. So the first type of thorn and thistles that we experience is anxiety, illness, injury, and exhaustion. Exhaustion. Solomon says in Ecclesiastes, what is a man from all the toil and the striving of the heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all of his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. His work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. This is also vanity. Does that describe some seasons of your work life? Even in the night, you don't rest. It's a vexation. You hear the frustration in his voice there? Work takes a toll on us. It's toil and it takes a toll on us. Physically, emotionally, even spiritually, at least partly because these days we can never get away from it. The example in the video here, it's funny, but that describes many of us. It's not just when we're on call, but the fact that we're always on call, that people can always get a hold of us. There's always an email. There's always a text. There's always somebody feeling like we can work at this moment, even if we feel like we want to check out. And this is a society-wide problem. In my practice, I deal quite a bit with what is called workers' compensation injuries. And this is an insurance system for people that have been injured on the job and then come get care for that. And it provides care, medical care for workers, and in some instances, replacement salary for their time off work. And it's a huge deal. In fact, it's such a big deal that in the United States, employers spend over $1 billion a week on workers' compensation issues, from the insurance, the time off, the medical expenses, all of that. Over $50 billion a year in this country spent on the thorns and thistles of injuries at work. So this is all a result of the fall. for more of you, for guys that are younger, that work more in white-collar type jobs, if you work in those kind of jobs, you're not immune to these kind of things either. I read an article about millennials and burnout that talked about millennials often think, well, I won't get burnout in my job because I'm not having to do the things my father or my grandfather did. They were working in a factory doing the same widget over and over. Of course, that would be feel meaningless and it'd be easy to get burned out. But it turns out when your whole life is about digital rearranging of things and looking at a screen that you can get burnout just as much. And so millennials and those of us in sort of modern digital careers are not immune at all to this sense of burnout and exhaustion from work. So all of us can experience this from some of the time, but some of us even promote this in the people that work under us. And as Christians, as guys who understand, at least understand now, some of these thorns and thistles, one of the things we need to think about as we imagine and think about the ways we experience these things is also to think about, okay, how do I maybe promote these things in the people that work around me and under me? Do I sort of create a standard that if you're not exhausted from work, then you're somehow not doing it right? When I was in residency, there was a saying that if you would tell someone they could go, because when you were an under-resident, when you were a lower-level resident, you could never leave until the senior resident said you could go. And so at some point, the senior resident would say, okay, you can go, we're done, I'll take care of the rest, or whatever they were going to say. And there was this thing that if you always said, okay, see you later right then what people would say about you is you don't have to ask him twice to leave. And it was a put down. You don't have to ask him twice to leave. Like, if you're a real man, if you're a real resident, you would have hung around and kept working even when I told you could go. That sort of attitude that promotes, if you're not staying to the point of exhaustion, if you're not working as hard as I'm working, then you're somehow not measuring up. We just got to be careful as we move into supervisory roles that we're not setting that kind of a, that essentially we're not promoting the thorns and thistles around us. Well, another thing that, another thorn and thistle is a sense of pointlessness. Pointlessness. Solomon says, so I hated life because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and striving after the wind. This is the guy who built this amazing palace. He built the temple. I mean, talk about fulfilling work. He was the king. He was one of the richest men that ever lived, and yet even his work became vanity and pointlessness. Striving after the wind, that's a phrase that means you're trying to catch something that you can never catch because you can never catch the wind in your hand. Work is originally conceived by God, was purposed toward the mission of God, but because after the fall, work becomes about us, it can seem futile and pointless when it's not pointed to where it needs to be. So all of us work in places full of sinful people with sinful purposes, and we work amidst sinful processes, sinful systems, and in sinful organizations. So there is a reason why those things will be pointless from time to time. Even the best corporation, even the best organization will have its moments of pointlessness. Even the best light work life will at times be pointless. That points us back to God. The next bullet is envy of others. We can be jealous, envy of others. So we can be exhausted and tired. We can feel like our work doesn't have any point. And then some of us get jealous. We envy others. Ecclesiastes 4:4 says, then I saw that all toil and all skill in work came from a man's envy of his neighbor. This is also vanity and striving after the wind. So what Solomon recognizes here is that for a lot of us, jealousy, envy, covetousness is oftentimes what drives our work ethic or our work performance or our work achievements. And not just that, when God originally created work, because he created it for a man and a woman and their children and their descendants that were supposed to be in perfect peace with each other, in perfect collaboration, that shalom that Mike talked about last time, that perfect peace, because that's how it was originally designed to be, those kinds of organizations and systems wouldn't have envy in them because everyone's motivations would be right. But now we're in systems under the fall, and so those peaceful purposes are corrupted, and therefore we experience envy in our heart, we experience among our coworkers, we have to deal with the conflicts that come with it. How many times over the last year have you dealt with a conflict that at its base was about envy or jealousness, or they got something that I feel like I should have had? This isn't fair to me. You weren't fair to me. That at its core is about envy. You know, for most of us, I think the rescue from envy is to learn a grace-filled contentment. And, you know, I've had friends, I don't know if it's unique to my generation since I'm a little older than a lot of you guys, but back when I was in my 20s and 30s, you know, there was a lot about kind of, I want to be in the perfect job, I want to be in the perfect fit. And I guess it's just kind of natural when you're early in your career that you are going to be thinking about, you know, is this the right job and do I need to move to something else? And there's a part of that that definitely is God moving you to the next thing. And that's, I think that's legit. And we need to pay attention to God when he's doing that. But I've also seen guys that are never content. Guys that could never be in the right job or the right relationship or the right whatever. Contentment was just not part of how they processed life. And I think it's worth us thinking about when we feel a wrestling in our soul that maybe it's time to move on, or when we feel like, oh, maybe there's something better out there. It's worth just asking the question to God, God, is this you moving me towards something different, towards something that more greatly fulfills your calling for me, that extends your kingdom? Or is this just me being non-content, discontent? Because I'm a guy that's always going to be discontent because that's part of my sin nature. And what's that about? What am I discontent about? Because for some of these guys that were discontent, they weren't so discontent with their careers, they were discontent with their life. One time I thought we needed to buy a lake house. And we didn't really have the money to buy a lake house because we had four kids in school and four kids on their way to Baylor. And I mean, I'm a doctor and I do pretty well, but there are limits to the amount of money you can make in a day. And I have reached that amount of money with three kids at Baylor from time to time. But somewhere in my mind, I got that we needed to have a lake house, honestly, because a lot of my partners had lake houses. And, you know, I was able to couch it in terms of, I need a place to kind of relax. I need a place to retreat to. I need a place that our family can go to kind of just be a family and be distracted. And my wife, who, you know, understood kind of what was going on in my heart, finally said to me, you know, we could probably make the lake house thing work, but I just don't understand why you feel like you've got to have it. What is it you're trying to get away from? Isn't that the issue? And she was exactly right. I was kind of bored with my work. I was kind of envious of other people and their seeming ability to relax. I was discontent with my station and my situation. And I felt like this kind of toy, this kind of place to retreat would help me escape from that. That's exactly what I wanted to do, escape, rather than deal with the discontentment. That's what I had to go back and do the work of doing, is deal with the discontentment. Well, the next point is confusing work with identity. We don't just get jealous. We see that work is really who we are, our identity. And we looked at Genesis 11 the first week about building the Tower of Babel, so I'm not going to go into that. But it's just simply the idea that when our work is no longer a reflection of being an image bearer about God, then it's going to be my identity. It's going to be a reflection of who I think I am. And this is why the first thing we ask people when we meet them is, oh, what do you do? What do you do for a living? Because that's the closest thing we can come to what our identity is. I live and breathe this every day. You know, I get new initials by my name. I get a new prefix in front of my name, Dr. Pruitt, when I got my job handed to me, when I got my career handed to me. That's an identity issue. And the more I lean into that, the more I'm going to lean into the effects of the fall. I don't know if any of you ever knew a guy named Bill Smith. Bill Smith was about 20 years older than me. He was one of the original folks here at this church that kind of was attracted way back 40 years ago. And Bill Smith was an investment advisor. I think Bill was responsible for bringing Walmart to market, I believe. He had a hand in that. He was a super successful guy. And along the way, his life kind of fell apart and he became a Christian. And he became a great discipler of men and continued to be a great wealth manager. And his company even survives today. But Bill used to always tell the story that when he would introduce himself on an airplane or wherever he was, instead of saying, I'm a wealth manager or I work with people's money, what he would always say is, when people would ask, what do you do for a living? He would say, I work for a king. And then people would say, you work for a king. And he would go on to describe the king that he works for. And initially, he would talk about it in kind of human terms. I work for a guy who was originally in the Middle East, and kind of talk about things like that. And over time, quickly it became apparent that he was talking about Jesus. Jesus was the king he'd work for. And that exactly was Bill's identity. I mean, if you just met him, you would never know he was a wealth manager or investment advisor because he was all about his new identity that he got in Christ. He really did work for a king. That was his calling. That was his job. And he was able to articulate that in a way that actually was kind of corny and winsome all at the same time. It was pretty amazing. Well, the final thing is we can make work an idol. It makes sense that if we kind of tend to worship ourselves and we're going to make work about our identity, then we're eventually going to make work an idol. We'll make work an idol. In the book Every Good Endeavor, Tim Keller says, we have an alternate or counterfeit God if we take anything in creation and begin to bow down to it. That is to love, to serve, and derive meaning from it more than from the true God. So I think if we look at our work lives, I'm sure we can find ways where we do this. We love it. We serve it, we bow down to it, and in those ways we begin to make it a god. Martin Luther said that idolatry is looking at any created thing to give you what only God can give you. Any created thing to give you only what only God can give you. I think Keller talks about this as work is a good thing, but it's not an ultimate thing. And one of the most helpful things that my friends around me have told me when I'm in distress over something not going my way, it's usually because I wanted something that I thought was a good thing and I thought might even be part of God's plan. And they were wise enough to say to me, what you wanted was a good thing, but it wasn't the ultimate thing. You got to keep in mind the ultimate thing. That's what God is, and work is not our ultimate thing. There's a verse in Jeremiah that talks about this. For my people have committed two evils. They've forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and they've hewed out cisterns for themselves, broken cisterns that cannot hold water, that can hold no water. So the concept here that was talked a lot about in A Man and His Traps is that idolatry is always rejecting God as your source of life. That's where it starts. And then finding life in a created thing, something like work. That's where idols come from. We reject God, we accept something else, we accept the broken cisterns. So what are the broken cisterns that you tend to go for? How are you cursed as a worker? How do you end up being part of the curse as a boss, if you're a boss? Where does that come into play? Well, number three says there is good news and there is good news. This is all crummy, crappy, bad news. It totally sucks. Why are we here? Well, we're here because God put us here to ultimately do something glorious, and that's the redemption that we get in Christ. So through the redeeming actions of Jesus Christ, God is overcoming all brokenness caused by sin. Revelations 21:5, I am making all things new. So God's redeeming actions. Remember how we talked about the first week that even though work was good when God created it, it wasn't everything that it will be. In the same way that our identity isn't everything that it will be, it anticipates what comes in the new kingdom. So it could be perfectly good and still be incomplete because God had a work for us to do on earth. That work got messed up and corrupted. But ultimately, when Jesus comes back, he is doing the redeeming work of making all those things, not just new, really, but the way God always intended them to be. It's like we leapfrog over to what? The way things were supposed to be. So let's kind of track back for just a second and look at some of these thorns and thistles and just hint at some things we're going to talk about next week about how some of these things can begin to be redeemed, because I just don't want to leave you here with all gloom and doom. I want to kind of give you some hope about some of these things. So first, in the area of exhaustion, a thorn and thistle is that work is exhausting, it's tiring. Well, one of the ways God redeems that is that he gave us from the very beginning the Sabbath. He gave us rest, the sense that there's a rhythm to our lives and that it involves work and rest. And by the way, we talk a lot about work and life balance, or at least we think we're supposed to. And every time I think about work and life balance, I never can get it quite right, because I always feel like it's supposed to be kind of 50-50, or I'm supposed to actually value life more than work. And I can just never feel like I can add all those up to the correct way, because work seems so overwhelming. Well, the biblical example is not 50-50, it's 6-1. Okay? 6 days work, 1 day Sabbath. I don't think our problem is that we work 4.5, 5, 6, 6.5 days full blast. I think our problem is, in large part, we don't take a real Sabbath. We don't understand what it is. We don't know what that kind of biblical, scriptural, God-filled rest really is. And that's why we can't work 6 days, or why we get exhausted when we work 60, 70-hour weeks, or sometimes even 40-hour weeks. So you have to add that up for yourself and factor what your family means in there. And it was an agrarian society back then. We don't have that now. They worked at home. We don't. There's all kinds of issues there. But there's a rhythm to life that God intended for us that he never got away from, that there's a certain amount of work, a certain amount of true Sabbath rest. And if we don't hold to that, then we're going to get tired. And the other thing I think that we have to think about when we're working so hard and getting so tired is, what are we working for? What are we really working for? Financially, what are we really going for? And is my spouse and my family on the same page with me about what our needs are, what we want? I can tell you, it doesn't matter whether you make $60,000 a year, $120,000 a year, or $520,000 a year, you will find ways to spend all that money, and it won't feel like enough, because the needs are always there. And it doesn't seem like it would be, but it does. And some of this is driven by what we're going for in terms of the kind of house we want, the kind of cars we want, the material things. We just have to be honest about that, that materialism sometimes drives our working to exhaustion. And we just got to be honest about that and come to grips with that. One of my good friends was a financial guy, not this financial guy over here, but a different financial guy. And he got caught up in kind of a scheme with a guy that wasn't ethical. And this guy ended up committing suicide. But it was kind of a Ponzi scheme type deal that it just kind of exploded on him. And this guy ended up losing his license to be able to be a financial advisor. And he had to kind of find a different career. And one of the things his wife said to me that I thought was pretty interesting is she just kind of confessed one day that, you know, she bared a role in this, because just as much as he did, she loved all the things that money brought them. She loved and reveled in the increased funds, the increased salary that he got from all these investments. And in many ways, she said, I could see how he felt like he needed to keep going because I was enjoying that so much. So we just got to be on the same page with our spouses and our families about what we're chasing after. I think our pace is often driven by what we're trying to get financially. And so if our pace is too heavy, it's probably because our financial goals are too heavy. When it comes to pointlessness, there will be pointless periods in our work. I think that's the takeaway from this. When we understand that God redeems our work, but that we're still in a fallen world, it gives us a new perspective on pointlessness, and we can persevere We can be grateful for the things we have. We can find contentment in times of testing, which is what periods of pointlessness are. We don't have to get stuck there forever, but we can endure it for a season. When it comes to envy, how can we redeem envy and work? Well, I think a grace-filled life, one where you're processing everything through the lens of grace rather than how the world adds up things, that's how you begin to get around envy. People that are full of grace, they think the best about people, they want the best, they hope for the best. They're glad when good things come someone else's way, and they can be a cheerleader, encouraging them on. You can be happy for your partner who gets a bonus and a raise. You can cheer him on for that. That's what grace-filled people do, because we die to self because someone already died for us. So when you struggle with work, ask yourself, where are the thorns and thistles? Where are the thorns and thistles? Think that through. And where do you need to confess that you get stuck in the thorns and thistles, that you're trapped by those? Where do you need to believe differently about what God can do for those things? Where can you repent and come back to a more original view of calling? Well, that's all for today, and we'll move into our time of questions. I hope that as you're working through the homework sections of this, I hope that you will spend some time thinking about your calling and what you see God doing in light of the things you bump up against. Because that's what's happened to me, is I got a good view of my calling, then I began to run into things. My own sin, my own sinful heart, my own immaturities, the people around me that didn't think the same way. And that's really when I began to process in full what God's true calling for was. I used to think that my calling in life, aside from being an orthopedic surgeon, I really thought that my calling was to be a reformer, that God made me to be a guy that kind of sees how things are and wants to do things differently. And I can figure out how to do things differently. I can articulate that. And so I kind of came to the conclusion that this was ultimately God's calling for me to be a reformer, and so I started looking for opportunities to reform things. And that's okay, and that is who God made me to be. But I think the deeper that I went into that, one of the things I figured out was that reforming things is hard. it's hard to change entrenched systems and things. And what I found, though, was that my greatest calling was not to reform systems, but to come alongside God in helping reform people. Not that I know the best way for them to be, but it was the relationships, it was the discipleship along the way that I began to see as my real calling. So I don't really look anymore for opportunities to reform things. I look for opportunities to reform if I can have a close relationship with somebody in the midst of it. And so if somebody wants me to go fix something at the hospital, I'm not really going to do that, but fix something in my group where I'm working with three or four guys and get close to them, I'm all about that. So this is kind of how God can work in our calling to kind of revise that for us. Well, let me pray for us as we go into our small groups. Father, thank you for your gift of work. Thank you that in spite of the difficulties we have, that you give us hope, you give us light. Thank you that you just illuminate to us what the thorns and thistles are. And I just pray that as we bump up against those things, even today, Father, even as we get frustrated today, that you would just help us to see those things in the light of redemption, that we'd begin to be about what you're doing in the world, and that you would just give us hope and calling and peace in that. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.